What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
2 days call for cookouts and lots of laundry. This Memorial Day at Lowe's, save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Gas Grill. Now just $199. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep dishes, clothes, and food fresh. Having fun in the sun is easy with us in your corner. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/27. While supplies last, selection varies by location. See associate or Lowe's.com for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
First degree murder with special circumstances. Lying in wait, financial gain, killing a witness, lewd acts with a person under the age of 14. Mutilation of the remains. Those are the charges that have now been filed against David Anthony Burke, the artist known as David, D4VD, in the death of 14-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez. It's finally come down. Prosecutors say Celeste walked into his Hollywood Hills home on April 23rd of last year and was never heard from again. Her dismembered body was found 5 months later in the trunk of his Tesla. The DA says the death penalty is on the table. And that's where we drop. That's where we begin today, Tuesdays with Bob, here on the podcast. Tuesday. Robin Dreek, retired FBI Special Agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, of course, with us. And Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Go check it out wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Let's start there, Bob. Prosecutors didn't just charge first-degree murder. They stacked special circumstances on top of it. It's like an infomercial. But wait, there's more. Lying in wait, murder for financial gain, killing of a witness. In California, that's death penalty eligible material. When the DA loads a case like that on day one, is that about what they can actually prove? Or is it about going in crazily strong with a lot of leverage and controlling the narrative?
I think it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
I really do. In this case, I think it probably leans towards the proof. I mean, it took them a long time to arrest him.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. Months and months. We're all like, what the hell is going on? Like, they found her in his car. Like, what? Like, where's the arrest? And then it finally happens. You know, but I could tell you, DAs in LA do not file death eligible cases on a whim. You know what I mean? Like, they're not coming in with weak evidence. So, by all accounts, it appears that they've built a pretty strong case, you know, because each one of those allegations has to be proven independently of one another, obviously. So it's interesting, man, you know, and it's like I never heard of the guy. Like I didn't listen to his music. I wasn't aware of him until this case broke. So I didn't kind of understand the significance of it. But You know, when you started to hear kind of the factual background that she was missing for so long, I just raised so many questions in my mind. Like, where was the family? You know, not that I'm putting anything on the family, but
yeah,
my 14-year-old's gone for months.
I got questions there too. I mean, I'm not giving the family a free pass on any of this shit because I'm sorry. We both have children of that same age, and I can't conceive of ever being, oh yeah, she went out with her 19-year-old boyfriend who's a music artist, and she didn't come back. Like, it's just another day in paradise.
And we've seen a lot of parental failings across all the cases we've been covering lately. Complete failures
everywhere. 100%. Yeah. And I'm not saying that I mean, they're mourning. I get it. But I'm sorry. It's not a free pass because your daughter is dead that you didn't fail her as well, because you did. Yeah. That's what it is. I'm sorry you failed your daughter. I'm sure you feel horrible about it too. Maybe this should be a lesson learned for other folks who are currently failing their children. You know, how it could end.
It could be one of those cases where, you know, I hate to say it, but survivor's guilt might be very earned.
Yeah.
No doubt. No doubt.
I don't wish it on them whatsoever, but I'm sorry. I'm not just going to pretend, justice will be. Yeah, well, you know what? Maybe if there was a little better parenting to begin with, we wouldn't be in this position to begin with.
Yeah, that's dude, it's so true. And, you know, but I mean, ultimately, the way that I think this thing will play out, if in fact it goes to trial, which, you know, if you're listening to what his attorney is saying, it sounds like it's going to.
Yeah.
But, you know, attorneys always talk that game early on in the game. You know, my client's innocent. We're going to fight to the... Mm-hmm. You know, so like things change as discovery starts to come in and you start to look at it and you're like, wow, you're screwed here, man. Like they've got some pretty powerful shit.
And I want to kind of begin asking you, because it's something that came to my mind, and I'm being very cautious as we begin this, because you've taught me to be learning from you over the years here on these cases. You know, obviously, the spotlight's on the DA right now. It's their time to shine. It's their time to say their big piece and make it look like this is cut and dry and it is what it is. Obviously, the defense is their turn to do it, too. We're going to go to trial probably at some point. Is there anything to be said of the strength of this case with the fact that the way that he has been arrested and has been charged? It wasn't through a grand jury indictment. It was him being arrested under what is it, probable cause, basically, or something of that nature. And then eventually the DA comes back within 48 hours and makes the charges. Anything to be said there?
I don't think so. I think that it was probably really done that way in order to kind of shine a light on it, you know, because we all became aware of it when the, you know, when the arrest took place. You know, I was tweeting about it. It was strange to me the way that it was done, because, you know, and it's different, like in different jurisdictions, but there's a pretty bright line rule in terms of your ability to keep somebody detained in custody for beyond 48 hours without it slipping into the realm of being unconstitutional if you don't charge them, or at least go in and get some probable cause and get it on paper. And it was sounding like that they hadn't done that, because I saw some maybe misreporting that he had been charged by complaint, which I think turned out not to be true. And we knew that he wasn't indicted. So, but I think ultimately they wanted it to play out over the weekend. I think even though, you know, I think there was the aspect of them being, you know, hoping that they'd be able to take a run at him in terms of being able to get him to talk, even though he knew he was repped, you know, and I'm sure his lawyer went in immediately and said, my guy's not talking to you. So, you know, go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, given the way that the floodgates look like they opened, you know, with all this information, with all these charges that I wasn't really expecting all at once, does it look like they got a flip on this?
I mean, kind of. Like, they had to have had something like substantial to get it to the point where they're at right now, right? Mm-hmm. And to go back to Tony's question, I think the biggest thing that we can take away from the amount of charges that were levied against them, they've been building the case. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that this is a situation where the left hand didn't necessarily know what the right hand was doing, that being law enforcement in the DA's office. I think they were in communication pretty heavily, because they're not coming up with these types of charges over a weekend. You know, I mean, there's a lot of thought, and I think we're going to probably get into some of the specific charges, because there's some novel theories here in the way that they're applying some of these charges.
Yeah.
You know, so there was clearly a lot of thought that was put into it. I think that they were playing it a certain way to the press in order to kind of get the lights on it and, you know, it was going to be the big day when they came out and issued the presser in terms of what they were charging him with. Yeah, so
smart moves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about the financial gain allegation, because that's specific. And it kind of takes us out of the realm here of, you know, was it a horrible accident of some sort? And then this is just a cover up by people who are young and dumb and don't know what the hell they're doing. And, you know, it ended up being, you know, the cover up ended up being far worse than the actual crime. The allegation here of financial gain, the DA said David allegedly killed Celeste to protect his music career because she was, quote, threatening it. That night, that means prosecutors believe they can prove motive here, that a 14-year-old girl was killed because she was a liability to someone's brand, essentially, you know, insinuating that if it came out that he's an adult, is having a relationship with a 14-year-old, that could destroy your career pretty damn quick. And the quickest way to protect that is getting rid of the threat, which is her. That's pretty specific to go in with that sort of a claim. One would assume they must have some sort of evidence to prove that sort of a motive. I'm guessing some sort of digital footprint, some sort of text, email. I mean, that's just my speculation. What do you think that they have to be able to leverage that sort of a charge that specific against David?
It is a very aggressive application of the financial gain aspect of mm-hmm. it. You know, it really is, because traditionally what you're talking about, like you saw it in Corey Richens, you're talking about like insurance proceeds, like, or they were trying to get to a will, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that's where it's kind of a motive thing, but there's actually a financial gain at the end of, you know, at the end of the crime for the person. So it was one of the reasons why they committed the crime. And here, like you said, man, it's like this concept of protecting a career really stretches that doctrine like quite a bit. And the defense is going to attack it on the legal grounds before it ever makes it to a jury. I mean, that's going to be one of the counts that's going to be very highly litigated, you know, but I think that we're seeing it more and more from prosecutors across the country in terms of them having a willingness to stretch kind of the boundaries of what have traditionally been established in terms of certain statutes. I mean, we mm-hmm. saw it with the Colin Gray case and the Crumbleys, where, you know, they kind of stretch these statutes to include people that wouldn't have otherwise have been prosecuted under that same statute ever prior to. So mm-hmm. I think that that's starting to embolden prosecutors across the country to say, all right, well, we think we can make it fit. You know, ultimately, if the charge survives pretrial motions, it's going to be up to the jury to decide whether or not, well, I think it's a bridge too far, or, you know, you're right. I see what you're saying here. I think it does fit. So it's going to be really a pretty interesting aspect of the case in terms of kind of law, like a law nerd perspective. You know, but they're going to have digital evidence, you know, yeah. I mean, in order to prove it, they're going to have, because obviously, sadly, Celeste isn't here.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not going to have the ability to be able to put her on the stand and say, yeah, you know, I threatened him with this the night of. So hopefully they have some kind of digital footprint, you know, that says whether it's DMs, texts,
yeah.
you know, where they're going at it. But, you know, the problem is she was typically with him, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not to say, look, I mean, my wife and I text from within the same house. If I'm upstairs, she's downstairs.
Sure.
You know, but I mean, the reality is we're usually screaming through the house because we're very loud people. But, you know, normal people, I think, you know, might hit each other up from it. So, I mean, there's a chance that it exists there. And again, I don't think they're bringing the charge if they don't have the ability to be able to prove it up in their minds. You know yeah. what I'm saying? So I anticipate that we're going to be able to see something that's kind of like saying, all right, look, this is the evidence that we have. And we'll see that when it's litigated pre-trial. I mean, they're going to have to put some kind of offer of proof up in order to show that, look, this statute applies here, and this is why, and this is the evidence that we have to support it. So,
yeah, it's interesting with this financial aspect, because, I mean, I dug into it a couple of days ago, and I literally just did the research on it again now. He's not any, you know, from what is open source and what you can garner, I mean, his net worth is a couple million. Granted, it's not chump change, but at the same time, it's around the realm of successful podcasters. I mean, this is not like someone who is huge. I mean, successful,
yeah.
But he's a TikTok success, you know. So it's interesting that they place so much value on him and his and this net worth and financial side when it's not a lot there. I mean it's there, but I don't know. I still think it's when you got a lot of 15-year-olds and teenagers and 20-year-olds doing stupid shit, you know, I think their digital footprint is going to give them up, because whether you have the David and Celeste text going back and forth is one thing, but I think everyone else in that circle, how do you shut them up? I mean, I don't think they're going to be shut up. I think that's why there's so many charges.
It's going to be really, really difficult. I mean, somebody in the inner circle had to have flipped. And I agree.
A lot of people in the inner circle.
yeah. I mean,
fear and a 20-year-old go hand in hand, generally.
Oh, yeah. And that's an easy flip there, too.
Yeah.
It's either you want to go down with them or you want to talk.
Because, in other words, you know, I mean, it's apples and oranges comparing this to like the Diddy case or anything related to it. But that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. I mean, this is we'll call an up and comer that is low end, moderately successful music wise. See, like you hadn't heard of him. I hadn't heard of him. I mean, some people have heard of him, which is great, but he wasn't mainstream making.
He's brand new. Tons. I mean, yeah. I mean, he had just performed at Coachella. He had his debut album coming out. There was a lot of potential.
Potential, right? Yeah, right. And potential energy, right there. That's where
it runs. You know, like, yeah. Both ways, really.
Do you litigate potential?
Well, like it's bigger than that, because I mean, the argument really would be from the DA's perspective. Look, I hear what you're saying. He doesn't have Diddy money. And that brand, but that brand's established. It's right. Like, look at the Kanye West shit. Mm-hmm. Like, the guy had lost his mind when he said, I'm all better. I'm taking my meds. You know, people, his brand was alive and well again. I think it's a stronger argument, frankly, when you are an up-and-comer, that there's a lot more incentive for you to go to great lengths, even mm-hmm. psychotic lengths, to protect that building mm-hmm. brand, because it's your way out. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to have already made it. So it's an interesting thing. I think it's the weakest of all the charges. But again, as a law nerd, I'm anxious to see him try to apply.
Yeah.
It.
And again, I still, because of the up and coming of it, means he doesn't have, and my reference really to the Diddy or even Kanye is the tightness of the circle, which they have reps of protection of their own breadwinner, because really without the main breadwinner at the center core, they're pretty much nothing. And him being an up and comer, that tightness of that core group, I can't imagine is tight enough that you wouldn't have everyone spilling their guts when threatened with, hey, you can get a few scraps today or you can go away for jail for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
I want to talk about another charge. Prosecutors have also charged continuous S acts and lewd acts with an individual under 14. And one of the special circumstances, then, killing a witness is tied directly to Celeste being a witness to those acts and also being the victim. So the prosecution's theory is that the S relationship with her created the motive to end her life, essentially. They're saying, and the defense for David hasn't addressed any of those specifically, but they have addressed the ending her life part, that he is not responsible. They've said in certain words, he's not responsible for the end of her life. Continuous S acts. That's an interesting phrasing, and you can probably expand upon that, Bob, a bit. But continuous S acts, they're going to have some sort of evidence to prove that that is what's going on. I'm wondering if it's digital. And number two, could this be a case where David ends up, maybe they can show that he wasn't responsible for her actual death, but he could walk away a registered S offender for the rest of his life for having done these sort of things continuously, according to the prosecution, with someone under the age of 14.
Yeah. And I mean, it's classic prosecutorial architecture, really.
Yeah.
And they did it in a really kind of elegantly cold way, mm-hmm. you know, because the S crimes do two things at once. They really establish the motive mm-hmm. for the murder. And then they also bootstrap, you know, the killings of, you know, the killing a witness special, you know, because like that's the other part of it. Because that's, you know, when I say special, it's those that word is what's making it potentially a death penalty case. Mm-hmm. So, and when I'm talking about bootstrapping, it's basically where they're saying, okay, I'm gonna put this saddle on this other really strong charge in order to get to the second charge.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the concept of bootstrapping, and prosecutors do it all the time, and it's a very effective way to get convictions on those charges. You know, the fact of the matter is that she was the only living witness mm-hmm. to a felony that would have ended his career, his freedom, and everything that comes along with it. So what's going to be interesting is kind of the cross admissibility, you know, because in a S crime prosecution in LA or in California, you know, you can introduce the kind of the SO evidence. Mm-hmm. So even if it's an uncharged conduct, meaning that they can show patterns, prior victims, grooming behavior, they can put all that stuff in. And then that makes the underlying S case way harder to defend in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. And it makes the murder case much harder to peel apart in terms of that bootstrapping concept from the predicate offenses. So predicate is kind of like a charge that you have to, you know, something that you had to have done in order to have committed this other thing. You know, the best way to kind of explain predicate offenses is in terms of like the meth trade. So when they started making Sudafed, you know, they made that as a predicate offense to cooking meth, because as they started to develop these cases, they started to learn that that was one of the primary ingredients, that these guys would go out to different pharmacies, buy up tons of Sudafed, and then use that to mm-hmm. cook up the Sudafed. So when they started realizing, all right, well, this is the way to nail them on it, we're going to start making people have to give their IDs if you're going to want to go in and get like Sudafed. You know, so what you do, like if you go mm-hmm. into a pharmacy, at least in our state and most states, you got to give your ID, and that's so you're on their radar mm-hmm. and then they'll know. And that's really a precursor predicate of cooking meth. So think of it that way in terms of how they're trying to kind of layer that particular charge in to bootstrap it to the murder charge. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to get them. Those are the charges against David. Weigh in. The links are in the description. David Anthony Burke is facing the most serious charges the Los Angeles County DA's office can bring. That David, D4VD. First degree murder, special circumstances, a possible death sentence. His defense team says he didn't cause Celeste's death, and that they've said it in language that sounds like they already know what the evidence actually shows, which is interesting. We do not. Fighting the charges is heavy in a case this public with a 14-year-old victim. It's a different kind of war that they're walking into. Blair Burke's statement, which is David's attorney, saying he's innocent in a vague sense, but he did not cause her death. That's the specifics of what the verbiage is. If the defense already knows the cause of death from sealed autopsy findings, which they probably do, then they're confident that it helps them. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is with us to help break all this down. Bob, what kind of what kind of alternative explanation could that language be setting up there, that he did not cause her death? Not he's innocent, he did not cause her death from a defense standpoint.
I mean, it's very carefully worded, right? So I think when they're saying he didn't cause her death, they're saying it wasn't by his hand specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he was the one who was he was the architect of the murder, though. So meaning that somebody else did the dirty work. But much like in any case where if you hire a hitman, you didn't actually cause the death per se, is mm-hmm. in terms of being the person who committed the crime and actually killed the person, but you're just as responsible under the eyes of the law as the person who pulled the trigger or used the knife, whatever the mode of the murder was. So it's interesting, you know. And the other part of it is kind of the premeditation aspect of it. And, you know, like lay people, a lot of times I think confuse what premeditation mm-hmm. might mean, thinking that you really have to be planning this thing out for an extended period of time. You know, that's just not the case with the law. I mean, it has been well established that premeditation can form in seconds.
Yeah. Essentially, if it went down kind of the way we're reading the tea leaves or the way it's being described, that she went into the house on the 23rd, I believe, and then never came back out, that she's dead because she was a threat to his image and his career because the tea may spill to everybody about the relationship that was going on. That in itself, having all of those pieces built together, does that add up to you? Does that make sense that all this could truly be what took place here in this situation between the two of them that night? That in the conversation, she said something to the effect of, well, I'll expose you. I'm just throwing randoms out here. And then he made a quick calculation, and that was premeditation. That calculation of, well, if she's going to do that, I should get rid of her. That would be premeditation, wouldn't it?
Oh, 100%. Well, yeah. And look at it this way. I mean, we don't know kind of the course of how this played out.
Yeah.
You know, this played out over months.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, she was gone for a long time. And frankly, lying in wait in and of itself is a form of premeditation.
Yeah.
If the prosecutors can show that David invited Celeste into his home knowing what was going to happen at the end of the day, that's premeditation. You know what I mean? Because, like, if he invited her in initially, you know, without her, like, maybe there was some kind of threat of an outcry, like, earlier on. And he's like, oh, shit. He's like, I got to handle this. And he invites her into the house knowing, like, I can't, like, invite her into my house. And then, like, the next day she's dead because that seems pretty sus. You know, so he's like, instead, I'm gonna bring her into the fold. I'm going to have her stay with me. And then, you know, one day she's going to show up dead somewhere else. Like, in his mind.
Does she ever even need to have made a threat of, I'm going to expose you? I mean, it would be pretty common knowledge to David that if word got out that he was doing inappropriate things with a child, that would probably end his career. It doesn't necessarily need a message from the victim going, hey, by the way, this might destroy you. If he just he knows this, anyone would know this, that could be the cause and effect of this sort of scenario, of this situation, that he's allegedly having this relationship with this girl. She doesn't have to say boo. Could it just be at some moment in time he weighs the risk and goes, my album's about to come out, I got a world tour that's coming up, the last thing I want is for this kind of information to drop. And he just makes the decision one day of, like, she's too much of a liability, she loves him, everything's great, maybe there's, like, nothing that she says that she's gonna expose him, but he just knows damn well people will figure out what's going on and that will destroy him. Just him connecting those dots, is that enough to describe those charges?
Yeah, I think ultimately it is. Yeah. It's not optimal. I mean, you'd rather have it the other way because it's more compelling. You know, but this kind of, like, dovetails back into what Robin was talking about with, like, you know, your Diddy or Kanye, where they have huge money, you know, because, like, those guys typically handle these types of issues with money. You know, they pay people off to keep quiet, you know, and then they continue to pay them off to keep them quiet. This, as we've discussed, I don't think was really an option for him because he didn't have that kind of money. So ultimately, though, at the end of the day, I don't think that they need any kind of actual proof of an outcry because they can make the argument, you know, exactly the argument that I just made. Him paying her off wasn't the option. The only option he really had was to get rid of her.
Yeah. So I think it's going to be an interesting challenge for the prosecution on this, and I'm going to try to channel a little bit of my inner Bob now on defense side, and that is, you know, there's no reps of really crazy behavior. And granted, I know music industry and everything, but I mean, when I try to do all the research on everyone in this circle, to go from it, to my optic, they're going from 0 to 100 on healthy interactions, healthy-ish, you know, with this up-and-coming star, to murder, death. I think, you know, I'm just put myself in, you know, projecting forward. If they don't plead out and it's on a jury and they're trying to show premeditation and the prosecution's saying, I mean, they got to overcome for a jury beyond reasonable doubt with everyone that everyone that was involved in this in a circle had a clean record. There's been no prior charges, no history of violence recorded, as we know yet, at least as I know from my research, to all of a sudden they want to murder her to protect the image.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a stretch unless there's more in there that they can throw in there, like with text messages and things like that, because from the optic I see right now, it still looks like an accidental, stupid 20-year-old dumb shit going on and them trying to cover it up because it's hard behaviorally for me to see why they would take that action and they thought it was in their best interest when a lot of people knew she was going to this house, seeing him, and that they thought it was a great idea. Granted, prefrontal lobe is not fully formed yet, but someone along that path said it's a great idea to kill her.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're putting logic into it.
And, I said, that's why you never know.
Which I appreciate, man. But, I mean, you make a great point at the same time. But, you know, a lot of times in these situations, and like you said, we're not talking about a fully developed prefrontal cortex yet. And, you know, you're dealing with, like, a bunch of guys that are in the same boat. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where they're not sitting there as, like, kind of a mastermind think tank in terms of how to handle this situation. They're a bunch of kids which I think
makes a great point too, Bob, is that because I don't think any one individual would be capable of this. It would actually have to be a group mentality of collective stupid that said this was a great idea. And so I think it's hard to imagine just one charge. I mean, not one charge, multiple charges. It's one person being guilty of being involved in this just because just the stats on dismembering a body requires at least two people as well.
100%. And you're exactly right. And that goes back to that conversation we were having about, you know, people flipping, you know, and how is that going to sit with the public? How is that going to sit with the jury in terms of, all right, they decided to hang it on the dude with the dough, but, you know, we've got a crew like an entourage,
right?
You know, that's basically walking on this thing because they all flipped, even though it's pretty clear they all had a hand on it or in this thing.
Right.
And, you know, to me, the biggest problem for the state in this case is going to be the decomposition of the body.
Yeah.
You know, because that ultimately, they're not going to be able to tell that jury exactly how she died.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was strangulation, blunt force, I mean, poison, they just don't know.
Right.
You know, and they're not going to be able to. So, I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, they have to prove that she died unlawfully, you know, and that he caused it, and that, you know, that he had formed the intent to do it before he did it, you know, so that it wasn't a heat of the moment type thing. So
it's definitely going to be digital, man. It's got to be there, I think.
It looks like you said, somebody flipped. Like,
yeah, combination.
You know what I mean? That's like, to me, that's more important than the digital evidence.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because, yes, I mean, we see it every day on social media. People do stupid shit. You see people filming their own crimes all the time. I mean, it's like unbelievable. I'm like, what is that dude doing, man?
Well, the digital gave him who to talk to and gave him the weak links to attack first.
Right.
And so that's where it gave you the leakage of, all right, we need to go for this guy, and this guy that they would otherwise been completely unaware of. You know, anytime you're trying to learn the secrets of any nation, you know, and you're trying to recruit a spy or flip someone, like in some of the work I did, the easiest thing is not to try to recruit the spy. You recruit the guy taking out the trash because they're actually carrying out the shit that everyone actually knows and everyone totally, they're oblivious to everyone. You know, they're invisible. So you go for the invisible people first.
Always.
To that entourage.
Always. And then, I mean, the reality of that situation, again, that is the easiest flip in the history of flipping because you're dealing with young guys that are like, your life hangs in the balance right here. Like, whatever you decide to do in this moment in time is going to set your course for the rest of your days. And you have a choice, and your choice is to go down with the ship, and that ship is sinking, or you can help us.
And with an LA homicide detective with 20, 30, sometimes 40 years of reps of these types of interviews going against a 20-year-old who it's their first time, I wonder who's going to come out ahead on the interview strategy.
I'm wondering about this because it feels like the defense of David is already somewhat in a corner by the way that they're verbing things. Basically, it's bad, but it's not that bad. is kind of what I think they may be facing if they end up in a trial here at some point. Aside from David pleading guilty, which I don't foresee that happening, is there a world here, Bob, where there may be some sort of a plea deal reached? Obviously, there's so many more things that need to happen before we even get there. But just kind of predicting the future as best we can with the blocks that we have in our playground. Is there a world where that could take place here, where maybe he would plead to some lesser charges? Would the DA even offer that? Would they even want that? Or if they're going through already and grandstanding the way that they are, saying, we got all this, would they even want to go that? Or is it, no, we're taking this to court, you're going down. Either you admit to it all or we're taking you all the way down ourselves.
The easy answer to that is, we don't know until the defense attorney sees the evidence.
Yep.
You know, because I mean, that's when you know what they've got.
Sure.
Because at this point, it's all just grandstanding by both sides. States out there saying we've got a slam dunk case and defense saying, well, my guy didn't do it. Good luck proving it. And, you know, once the discovery starts flowing in and you start to see what they have, that's when you start having a serious conversation with your client. You know, I mean, if it looks like they have the ability to be able to prove this case up in a way that is going to convince a jury that he did this beyond a reasonable doubt, then you're having a very real conversation with your client and saying, look, you know, you're in trouble here, you know, and you need to really think about it. Do you want me to go and try to get them to take the death penalty off the table in order to spare your life? Or do you want to go in and fight it? If, you know, the state is of the position that they're not going to budge on the death penalty, well, then they're going to go to trial on it, because at that point, your job becomes less about, you know, proving innocence or guilt. It becomes about saving your client's life in terms of the death penalty. And, you know, you're going to put the fight up. So I don't know. I mean, it just depends on what they have on them, you know, It's kind of a fascinating case in that sense, because you really just don't know how they were able to build the case because of the condition of the body. You know what I'm saying? And like, you don't really even know when she died, you know? So it's like, you've got that thing, like, where if they're going to come in and say, well, that happened the night of, well, how the hell do you know? Like, how are you going to prove that up? Is your medical examiner going to be able to come in and prove the time of death? And they're not going to be able to. Right. You know, just because they don't know.
Again, if the digital, pure speculation, we don't know, but they have the date now. They're saying the 23rd or something of when in the house didn't come out. I'm going to guess it must be digital. There must be something digitally.
And also the Tesla's data.
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to guess there's something there that gives them a much better timeline on what took place by the reactions and the communications of those around her in those moments. That's going to be real fascinating.
And it'll probably all be after the fact shit.
Yeah,
you
true.
Know what I'm saying? Like, not the planning and the execution of the execution, but really the how do we get rid of the body type stuff? Like, where are you at now? What are we going to do? Did you go get all the stuff that happened after it, which really kind of makes for a stronger case for the, you know, like the mutilation of human remains, false statements, tampering with evidence type charges. Like, even if they're not able to nail him on the homicide itself, which remains a possibility because of the issues of, you know, that we've been talking about, just the decomposition of the body and you know, the ability to kind of pinpoint a time in which it happened, are going to be serious hurdles that the state's going to have to overcome. But at the end of the day, he's not walking on all of it. It's kind of like that before the Robert Durst, you know, they started nailing him and he had that case down in wherever it was in Texas, and they couldn't get him on the homicide. And he basically was like, yeah, you know, I was around the body, but they got him on the mutilation of human remains, you know what I mean? And that was the only thing that they could convict him on, because it was very similar circumstances. In that case, the condition of the body was just so deteriorated that they couldn't make heads or tails of when the person died, how they died, none of it, you know. And ultimately, at the end of the day, that causation aspect in terms of the homicide charge is something that they have to prove up.
Interestingly, I just looked it up as we were talking about it. Teslas do record the opening and closing of the frunk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they record if you touch the damn thing.
If you breathe, how many breaths you took.
Current sperm count.
Another lesson of killers. If you're going to murder someone, don't put it in a super vehicle that's going to record everything you do.
Yeah. Don't pick the vehicles of the future. That's not a good choice. Go with a Pinto or something like that. You know, go with the Geo Metro. Those work.
The Pacer.
Gremlin.
Yeah.
All AMC vehicles.
Showing our age right there.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and do press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. Let's move over to another case the Duggars. Joseph Duggar, once a face of wholesomeness and reality TV, now faces a life felony in Florida for the alleged repeated of a 9-year-old girl in 2020. As of now, he is scheduled for a formal arraignment in Bay County, but the illegal exposure doesn't stop at the state line. A search of the couple's Arkansas home, triggered by the Florida arrest, reportedly uncovered exterior mounted locks on children's bedroom doors, leading to 8 misdemeanor charges against not only him, but his wife, Kendra. And now their 4 children are in state custody, not even with the family, not even with the Duggars. The state said, yeah, we don't think so. You're going over here. You're not going to be around them anymore. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is here with us to help break this down. I want to enter this conversation into the harsh reality of what this family is facing, specifically Joseph and Kendra, and speaking specifically to Kendra, if she's watching, if somebody's watching that knows her. We know many people are. When your husband is facing these sort of charges, he's allegedly already admitted to them on tape. It ain't looking good. It ain't looking good at all. And she's got her own charges against her for, I believe, endangerment with the locks on the doors. Kids aren't in her custody. If she has any interest in, I don't know, being a mom, having her children by her side ever again and not be in the custody of someone else, as a defense attorney, would you advise her to divorce this man immediately?
Yeah.
Okay. Kendra, there you go. There's your legal advice. All you need to know. And flip if you have any interest in having your children around you ever again.
Yeah.
Thanks for watching. Have a good night.
Bob's delivery.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. It's the only way out as far as I see it. Look, certain people have certain feelings about rats and snitches, but you know what? We as a species have just that. It's innate in us. The survival thing is,
yes.
And when it comes down to it, when it's right there in front of you and you're charged with that decision of, oh my God, what do I do in that moment? You know, we're typically going to lean towards preservation. I mean, that's just what we do as a people, you know? So yeah, I mean, I think her only way out of this in terms of, you know, being able to kind of walk away with this intact as best she can. You know?
I mean, the courts are going to look at this and they're going to make a determination at some point whether or not she's fit to have her children with her again.
100%, man. That's a big problem, T.
I mean, let's, for those who don't know, like Kendra, what sort of things might they take into consideration there, Bob? It's probably not how many IBLP workbooks one may have studied or whatever Jim Bob may have said over a chicken dinner. I'm going to guess it might go to things a lot more meaningful than that.
Yeah, I mean, they're gonna try to get into the, you know, kind of the nuts and bolts of it, you know, in terms of what was her hand in all this, you know, because knowledge in these cases is what kills you if you're a defendant, you know, even if again if you're not the one who's doing the deeds, if you knew about it, if you helped facilitate it, if you knew about it and didn't stop it from happening, you become complicit.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're complicit in it and with these kind of charges, people have very, very low tolerance. You know, when they view somebody as somebody who was in a position to stop something from happening and then they chose not to do it. And beyond that, it appears
that maybe she went beyond that, where she helped facilitate it. I mean, the locks on the doors, man, are not, you know, like
not good.
Not good, man.
Not good. I mean, and here's another thing that I want to, and I'm sorry, Rob, and I.
No, I know, no, I keep I'm listening today, man. I'm listening today.
Yeah, you know, it's another thing, and what we're learning within the IBLP, that's the religion that the Duggars are a part of, that so many things are handled in-house, under the umbrella, as they like to say. And if someone has knowledge of someone doing these sort of things to a child, they decide, you know what, we're not going to report this to the police. We're just going to handle this in-house. We've speculated on this about the family having knowledge of this and then it being influenced or pressured or coerced in one way or another, not to go to the authorities. That looks like that might be going on, in my opinion, allegedly. That's an interesting aspect to it. But what about her specifically? What if she knew? What if she had knowledge that this happened to a family member of her own and nothing was done? And she continued to have the children in the homes, because these allegations go back several years. These go back to like 2020, so it's like 6 years ago. If she knew that her husband had allegedly done these sort of things with that person who's that close to her and her own family, and she continued to not report anything and continue to have her own children around this man, her husband, their father, with that knowledge, I'm going to guess Child Protective Services aren't going to look at that and go, oh, you seem to make good choices. Seem like a great place for the kids. Here they are. Have them back.
Is that to me or to Robin?
That's to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, it was. It falls into what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's that thing where jurors in particular are not going to give somebody a pass on that.
No.
No. Mothers on that jury are not going to give somebody a pass on that, because mothers are like, you know, you're charged with being the mama bear. Like you are the one who, for all intents and purposes, is expected to protect your children at all costs. And if that means, you know, because the reality of a marriage is there is no blood between the husband and the wife. The blood is between the children and the parent. And that typically should take precedent, I would think. You know what I'm saying? Your loyalty has to lie. If you're in that unenviable position of having to make a choice, you're going to choose the kids. And that's how most people think, especially parents, you know, ultimately at the end of the day. So how that's going to play out is not good. It's a really, really tough position for her to be in. And, you know, the fascinating thing, which is, has you guys sucked so deep in this rabbit hole, is how does the cult in and of itself play into it in terms of the mental side of it, the psychological side of it, you know, because it goes beyond just a husband and wife relationship. You know, there's much more to it. There's so much at play in this thing that you can't ignore it, you know, in terms of decisions that were made and things that were done or not done. You know, there's a lot there to peel the layers back on the onion.
So Bob, do you think that Kendra, in these circumstances with her defense attorney, would be able to play, I came up with the term as I'm thinking about this, the NDA defense? Because we're talking with Amy yesterday, it hasn't aired yet, but, and we've read it in all the books and everything. Jim Bob has, you know, non-disclosure agreements fallen out his ass. I mean, he lays down NDAs for family members. He lays them down for everyone because he just wants to make control of that narrative. So is there any way that Kendra would be able to say it was all orchestrated by the Grand Imperial Poobah, Jim Bob, and I feared for my well-being and my family's well-being because he made me sign these NDAs. Is there any defense there that you can claim and push off on him?
I mean, you can put it out there. Nobody's buying it. NDAs aren't worth the paper they're written on. They're
right, but I know it's not worth the paper, but in her perception under that kind of control of that cult. Right.
I understand what you're saying. That goes back to what I was talking about with kind of like all the other factors at play. And ultimately, at the end of the day, are you going to be able to sell that to a juror? You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, well, there was this document and he used them like swords all over the place. And, you know, they were the shield. And, you know, that put her in a certain mindset that she was trapped, for lack of a better term, in terms of being able to speak out about it. And, you know, ultimately, is that going to be compelling to a jury? Maybe. I mean, maybe it is. But you're going to really have to get into the psychology of cults then. You know, because again, this is beyond just a husband and wife relationship.
Right. You're going to really have to show.
To me, it's akin to grooming. You know, like people just don't understand the psychology of grooming the way that they should.
Right.
And it's absolutely incumbent upon the state to put on, you know, psychologists and people that are going to be able to explain to the jury in a way that makes them understand how this can happen psychologically to somebody, you know what I mean? Where you put all common sense to the side and you're operating in a way that normal people just wouldn't operate, because everybody looks at these situations and is like, what? I don't understand it. How, like, I would never, number one, join a cult. Number two, if I do some shit, like, you know, like that's what everybody says in their own mind, you know, but when you're thrust into the situation, you're in it. It's a different thing.
Yeah. You're not thinking you're in a cult. You're not thinking you're signing an NDA for a cult at that moment in time. And it's being presented very differently right now. The insight, and we had a great conversation with Amy King Duggar yesterday. It'll be airing here on the channel tomorrow. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. But some of the insight that she gave, I said, what do you think is going on behind the scenes right now with Kendra, with the family? Because she's in the throes of the love bombing of the Duggars right now. And they are likely around her right now. You know, we got you. We're going to help. I mean, we can hear it in the jail calls, the sick, bizarre jail calls that have been released between the two of them. And they're likely promising her a lot of things to keep her in the fold, to keep her from going out and seeking individual counsel outside of who the Duggars decide to hire, who failed them already on Josh. Let's get him. He's worked out well. Sure, he's a lovely attorney, but not for this matter. When you have that sort of environment still surrounding this woman and she's still choosing to be a part of it, the environment that seems to have harbored these folks for so long, if you were to speak to Kendra directly and advise her as an attorney of, okay, if the interest here, which I don't know, I'm trying to think of what would inspire me. What would be my main goal if I was in this situation? It'd be to see my kids again. It'd be to have my kids in my custody. Everything else, everybody else can fuck
and stay off. Out of jail.
Yeah, I mean, everybody else can F the
well,
F
starts
off.
With that one.
I want to have my kids back. And I hope that that's the carrot that's on the stick in front of her. I hope that that's what's motivating her as a parent. I would hope. If that is the goal, what would you say to her? What would you say, what she needs to do, what steps she needs to take, who she needs to be surrounding herself with and not surrounding herself with to achieve the goal of getting those kids back? What does she need to do, Bob?
She needs to basically come clean, you know, because ultimately, in terms of losing those children permanently, it's not going to be in a criminal court. You know, that's going to be in a family courtroom, family law courtroom, and you're going to have a family law judge on there, and you're going to have guardian ad litems that are involved in the case that whose only representation interest is what's in the best interest of the children. And she's got a real uphill battle. Mm-hmm. Like, she just does. Like, if you're the state in this case, you're trying to sell her on the concept that she can get back with her kids.
Yeah.
The reality is, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. Like that, that's just the reality of it. And frankly, it should be the reality of
it.
But man, like you kind of made the comment off, like, you know, off the cuff, but it so goes to the heart of the psychology of it. When you're in it, you're not calling yourself a cult. No. That's what we on the outside looking in call it. You know, when you're in it, you don't, that's not the way you're thinking about it. You know what I mean? And that really
when
goes
you're in it, you're on the righteous path to heaven and everyone else is going to hell.
Exactly.
And so the second part of that question I'm curious about, Bob. So she's got an uphill battle for her to get her kids. What's the battle look like for the 18 other members of the family being able to get those kids? So she still has access to them. Is that good or bad?
If you're asking me, if I was sitting on the bench in family court, I wouldn't put him anywhere near any of those people. But that's, and I am one not to take children away from their parents unless it's required. Mm-hmm. And that would include extended family. And if the extended family is shown to be complicit in any way, like turning a blind eye, and again, it's so hard in this case because of the mindset of that thing that you were just talking about, Robin, mm-hmm. that, you know, they were doing things because in their mind, it was leading to the path that they felt that they needed to be on in order to get where they needed to be when their life came to an end. Right. And I mean, it's like, that's a real thing for some people.
Yeah.
You see it for, you know, all the time in the Mormon religion. And it's like more and more and more of these cases are coming up where it's like the Mormons are just unhinged. And I don't want to,
they're not even Mormon.
Right. You know,
but, extreme belief systems is where you see it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But like, well, where you're seeing it a lot is in the Mormon religion.
Yes,
I'm not training like a broad.
The FLDS side, the fundamentalist side.
Right. Right. You know, it's like you just, and it's that mindset that is so just built into their minds through years and years, probably since birth, of indoctrination to that this is the way that it is, and them not having the ability to be able to kind of really communicate with the outside world to have a thought that, well, maybe what I've been taught isn't right or there's another way to think about it. So I don't know, man, with the extended family, it's like you're in the same playpen, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know,
Oh yeah. But I was curious just because, you know, when the Duggars seemingly have so much control of that community because of donations, because the relationships everyone has with each other, because of the church, all these things, you know,
because people like being close to celebrity.
I mean, in order for them not to have an influence, you got to get outside the jurisdiction. You got to be in a different court system. I mean, so what's the likelihood of that happening? So you can actually get some objectivity. So people can make really healthy decisions for those kids. Otherwise, because I'm fearful that it's just going to be decided by the inside guys. And it's just going to, so, all right, Kendra doesn't get her kids, but you know, the families still get the kids. That's my concern.
It's not always that way though. You know, and like where it gets interesting is, you know, say for instance, you have a case wherein there's been a homicide involving a mother and a father, right? Mm-hmm. And depending on who's the one who was the actor, meaning the person who did the killing and who was the victim, you know, you have those situations where you're talking about, and there's children left over. And then it becomes the problem of figuring out where the kids are going to go. And you know, typically common sense is going to dictate it's going to go to the victim's family, as opposed to, you know, the perpetrator's family. And when I'm talking about like grandparents, you know, but it's not that simple because, you know, the grandparents aren't necessarily, you know, they're that guilt by association thing that tends to take place. Well, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree type thing is not always the case. So, I mean, it's just going to have to be, you hope, because you don't want children to become wards of the state. Right.
No,
I know. And I say it, and people in the comments are saying it too. You know, we've just covered so many cases in the last couple of years where child protective services failed.
It's a nightmare.
And, you know, yeah. And that's my concern is for the kids on this.
It's 100%. And it's a legitimate concern. I mean, I guess what you'd want to happen is find some relatives, some blood relatives that maybe weren't in it. You know, that we're on the outside.
Give him to Amy. give him to cousin Amy. I mean, throwing poor Amy under the bus.
You put a lot of heat on there, Robin. I'm sure.
She's too awesome.
She might be down for it, though. You know, but I mean, like, that's the type of person you're looking for if you're going to try to keep it in the family. You know, you got to look outside of the inner circle, the sanctum, and say, all right, well, this is going to be the best choice. And, you know, but you need a willingness, obviously, from that end. But, yeah, it's a sad case in a lot of different ways. You know,
it really is. It's a lot of so much failure, and so much control, all by people very misled on what they think their intents were. It's so disturbing. All right, your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Don't miss that interview with Amy King Duggar. It's going to be on the channel. It's dropping Wednesday. Wednesday in the evening, right? Is that right, Todd? I think it's in the
8 p.m.
Yep. 8 p.m.
Yeah, 8 p.m. Watch it. It's awesome.
Make an appointment to do so.
I'm excited to watch it.
Yeah, and check it out. It's we're going to be dropping it for the next 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, all three parts, and Monday the full thing will be dropping, so do check that out. Bob Mata, check it out, Defense Diaries, wherever you get podcasts, and on Buried. YouTube, and Buried. I was getting to it. You beat
Thank
me
you.
To it.
Thank
I was
you.
Just going to say, and Buried. And Buried. Also available wherever you get podcasts, the John Wayne Gacy story. Get deep into that like only Bob can, with only the tapes Bob has.
Bob.
Oh my God. It is such an amazing podcast. Highly recommend checking that out. So do check that out. Robin's latest book, it is available wherever books are sold. It's Not All About Me. Highly recommended. Buy it for Joseph Duggar behind bars if you'd like.
Yeah.
It would be helpful. Or really any of them that are still there in the cult. Okay. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, for Bob, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.